Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. I'd like to preface what I want to say with a couple of remarks. It's the first time I'm speaking in these new rooms, and I like the way you've named them. But to a German speaker, it's very confusing, because space means realm, and this is the same as room. So this is therefore, you know, time-space that I'm talking in. And the other room you've called space. But none of them are as bad as what happens when you go to Göttingen, where you give the seminar in Hilbert space. That's really difficult. The other thing I wanted to say, it's always, you know, coming back to the PI, one is reminded of the kind of spirit of the place, which stretches from very cutting-edge research at the kind of agreed frontiers of knowledge, but also, and I think probably above average acceptance of speculative ideas. So what I'm going to talk about today is definitely one of those rather speculative ideas. And it's grown out of a collaboration with Michael Attia, who, I should say, that Google is dominated by a British birthday today, but that's not the one that is relevant for this talk. Michael Attia is turning 87 tomorrow. So so we can also, I could dedicate this talk to him. So. This work that I present grew out of discussions I had with Michael, who is in Edinburgh. So Michael is in retirement, or Professor Emeritus, because retirement certainly is not in Edinburgh. And he's, as some of you know, has been interested in questions in fundamental physics for some time. And a lot of his work obviously is highly relevant to physics. And we had discussions some 5 or 6 years ago about some ideas of using four manifold theories for particles. And initially, I was very critical. I remain a sort of skeptic in this collaboration. But after a while, we did hit upon some ideas which I think are very interesting. And they're the ones I want to talk about. So this is an attempt to model particles in terms of geometry, an idea which has been around in various guises in many places. Some of you are better, more expert in it than I am. But it has various different twists to the story. So what I want to focus on today is a model for the electron as such a geometrical model. And I want to talk about how the spin of the particles and the time evolution may come in. And as is typical of working with kind of good ideas, which may or may not be physically relevant, is that they lead to good mathematics, whatever happens. So there is quite a lot of interesting mathematics in what I want to say. And quite often when I talk about this, I concentrate on this as a kind of mathematical physicist. But this time I do want to sort of emphasize the kind of physical ideas a bit more. So I want to take, well, these are papers stretching from the first paper that we wrote on this subject in 2012 to one that I put on the web yesterday with my student Rogelio Jante. So they all kind of enter in various ways, but I'll refer to them as and when necessary. So the plan of the talk is to tell you about the outline first. So the geometric models, what are they? How do they work? And then I'll focus on one particular geometry, the top nut geometry, which some of you may know very well. And I claim that I can interpret that sensibly as a geometry describing an electron. And then I want to explain that if you accept that, how does the spin of the electron come in? And then I'm going to throw a time evolution into this picture. So I'm going to have an exact time evolution, which in an unexpected to us way goes back to one of Dirac's braver ideas, the large number hypothesis that some of you, again, may know. And so this is, in some sense, an extremely Diracian talk. There's Dirac equations, there's Dirac monopoles, and then there's this Dirac large number hypothesis at the end. And finally, I'll point out some similarities with the Euclidean version of the Schwarzschild black hole and how that fits into what I want to say. OK, geometric models of matter. So let me tell you a little bit about the genesis of this. So my own research background before I got interested in 3D quantum gravity was in topological soliton models, like the Sckr model for protons and neutrons. So this is a model where, rather than using QCD, in fact, the model is older than QCD, you describe protons and neutrons as global twists in a liquid of mesons. That was Sckr's idea. And mathematically, what he took is a field which takes rise in a nonlinear target, namely the three sphere, and he wrote down an energy functional for maps from Euclidean three space to the three sphere, which have these stable solutions characterized by a winding number. And the winding number is the topology which Sturm interpreted as a Baryon number. So that's the kind of model, and the spirit of that model is what led to these geometric versions. And this Sturm model, proposed in the 60s, has continues to attract interest, to resurfaces at various points, and there's quite a lot of progress now in understanding the solutions of the Sturm model of the various degrees. So degree one would be a model for the proton or neutron. The quantization distinguishes between the two, but classically there's kind of one ground state and different quantum states correspond to proton and neutron. Charge two would be the deuteron, charge three would be heavy water, and so forth. So you got alpha particle is charge four, and then you can ask, what are these minima, what do they look like? And that's now known, so there's a very interesting kind of numerical study of nonlinear PDEs, which leads to these pictures. So these are pictures from a paper by Richard Batty and Paul Sutcliffe, which sketch your energy surfaces in this model from charge 1 to charge 8. And as you can see, it's a very nonlinear theory of binding. So if you compare this to the kind of old-fashioned pictures of red and blue balls stuck together in chemistry cupboards collecting dust, this is very different. So the deuteron, if you like, the classical model of the deuteron would be this donut, rather than two spheres stuck together, and the alpha particle would be this cube with holes cut through, and so forth. So these would be the classical states, and then you have to do semi-classical quantization to make contact with the physics of with nuclear physics. And for a long time, so there was a famous paper by Witten and Nappi that concentrated on charge one, and actually got quite good agreement with things like magnetic moments of the proton, quadrupole moments of the neutron, and so forth, from this charge one configuration. And quantizing anything other than charge one was a big challenge for a long time. And this is something I was interested in as a postdoc, which is now some time ago. So a lot of nuclear physicists said you can't have a deuteron being described by, I'm going to start using this hockey stick, by this shape. Because the deuteron doesn't look like a donut. We know that from experiments. And so that was one thing I was interested in at the time. And if you look in nuclear physics books, this is from Erikson and Weiser, classic book, shows you the energy density of the probability distribution of matter in the deuteron. So this is a picture that you will find with the black being the highest probability.
This is Mark with the quark model.
So there's no quarks. So this model by Sturm precedes QCD. So Sturm cooked this up before QCD came along. But Witten's paper with Nappi and then subsequent papers argued that you can get it as a large color limit of QCD. So that's the connection. It's an effective theory in the limit of large colors of QCD. So that's what sort of put the model into the ballpark of nuclear physics. But it's a model that's been used to study from proton all the way to ion nuclei. And it does a roughly 30% accuracy across. And there's very few models that do that range, that cover the range from a single proton to the two-body problem nuclear physics to heavy ions. And that's what the Sturm model is used for. So there's no quarks in the discussion. This is an effective theory.
This is experimental data.
This is the fit. So this is, as I say, from a nuclear physics textbook, which uses, as those who study this, we know there's various potentials describing proton-neutron interaction, the Paris potential, the bond potential. They all try to fit the data as carefully as possible. If you fit as well as you can, and then you solve the standard Schrodinger equation in the background, you get this distribution. So that's it's the accepted sort of picture. And what I wanted to show is that you can get the same picture from the skirmion. And the skirmion has this donut, but the donut is very soft when you want to make it oscillate. It doesn't mind being pulled apart. It's a very soft mode. And of course, you can spin it. And those are the quantum states of the spin of the isospin. So we looked at a 12-dimensional collective coordinate space near that donut, and we quantized those degrees of freedom and computed the lowest state. And then with the lowest state on this moduli space, we average the classical distribution of matter with a quantum wave function on the moduli space. So every point on this collective coordinate space would be one donut-like picture, and then you average them with the quantum wave function. And that's the picture you get. So it matches. And first of all, there is a bound state. I mean, this is, you know, the Dirichlet is a very sensitive bound state. It's a few MeV in a theory where you're talking about GeV. And you know, you're adding two protons, GeV each, and then you want a binding of the order of a thousandth of that. And so that there is a bound state, and that it comes so close was, you know, a sort of success. This is the kind of the background story. I'm not actually at the topic of the talk. But so this is the Sker model has been rambling on, and I realized it's going to get very numerical, so I sort of moved out of this field. But you know, there's a lot of very good work, and particularly I think this work leading to these pictures here is very exciting. Yeah. Yes.
Since it's only not the main topic, I'll make a very short comment.
Yes.
But this is all, I don't know if you mentioned, but all these solutions have not only a kinetic energy term, but an extra term, which is sometimes called the Sker term.
Yes.
That's needed in order to stabilize the Skermion at a classical level.
Right.
But it's not actually necessary to stabilize it at the classical level. The stabilization can be quantum mechanical.
Right.
And you get a different story without these pictures.
Right.
We'd be very interested to listen to about
you. I know your papers on this, and but I think it's been studied a lot, this question, for the single Skermion, but not very much for these higher ones. You know, what the effect of this quantum stabilization might be.
That's so, right. So yeah. I think it would be very interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I mean, so I mean, you know, I mean, I think the.
But we did do, I think, about six different variants.
Right.
Different states.
Right.
And the fits of the spectrum of masses is remarkably well fit.
Right.
So it's like higher spins and.
Yes, on the numeric scale. So if almost it's kind of the same level of accuracy, it's harder to involve kinetic. I mean, so these are, you know, statically you minimize an energy and then you quantize. If you have your quantum theory part of the, I mean, I don't know how that would work. And anyway, it's another discussion. And that, so, you know, this work goes on and there's very good work being done. Most of it involves heavy numerical input. So
one thing I could just to throw out if anyone's interested. You mentioned the higher variant numbers. I've thought for a while that the most exciting possible application would be understanding neutron star equation of state, because that's a very, very that's a huge variant number.
Yeah, so that's,
and there's
that's
no sort
of, again, there's work on that. I mean, lattices or skermions are studied, and that's it's a very interesting question. How you best, because they are very complicated interactions, and so on. But let me stop because I. How does this connect to what I want to talk about? There's a paper in 2004 or 2005, I think, by Sakai and Sugimoto, which is one of these, you know, huge impact papers that used idea from string theory to cook up what they're called dual QCD, and from which they then claimed that you this dual QCD picture is essentially a U2 gauge theory where the instantons they claim describe the baryons. And that is a four-dimensional theory, so it's a kind of holographic picture. But what was exciting about this is that they argued that to get the kind of term-by-term expansion, you have to do a kind of nonlinear Fourier series in the fourth dimension. And if you have an instanton, you know, what does it mean to do a nonlinear Fourier series? But without going into details, the constant term is the integral. But what's the integral of an instanton? It's the holonomy. And the holonomy of an instanton is a skermion. That was something that Michael Atiyah observed way back in the 90s, that if you have an instanton and you just integrate along one of the directions, you're left with a field that only depends on three directions. And that field is a skerm field. And also, it approximates a skerm field extremely well. It's one of these surprises. They're totally different theories. One is a gauge theory. The other one is a scalar theory. But if you take an instanton, you integrate one direction, the holonomy is to a very good approximation of the skerm field. I could show you pictures of skerm fields of all the degrees for which I showed you pictures, and you couldn't tell from the picture whether it's an instanton or a skermion. And so this work, however, said that this is just the first term. The truth theory has got this infinite tower of other mesons. So that's how they interpret this. And this work, I mean, so this has got, as I said, more than 1,000 citations. It's taken up very seriously in nuclear physics. And the message from that seemed to be that the Sker model is a kind of the first step in what really is a four-dimensional theory, of half-flat connections. And this is what led Michael and then myself to think, well, if you, this is kind of halfway to geometrizing this girl model. Let's go one step further. How can we get half flat connections in four dimensions? Well, gravitational instantons are exactly that. They give you an SU2 connection on a four-dimensional space. And so that was a kind of rather roundabout way in which we start asking, is it possible that you can get particles from four-dimensional manifolds which are half flat, so from gravitational instantons? And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So all of that was the kind of introduction. So I better move on. So the spirit of what we have taken from that is that, like in this Kerr model, we want quantum numbers to come out of topology. And symmetries from the geometry. So the idea of moving away from the gauge field on four-dimensional space, where the SU2 is put in by hand, is to say if you go to a four-dimensional manifold and you look at half-light connections, the SU2 is part of the geometry. It's not a gauge field that you put in by hand. So we wanted more geometrical origins of the gauge symmetries that occur in the model. Then we realized, looking at some examples, that those of you who know the gravitational instantons are Euclidean solutions of the self-duality equations. They imply the Einstein equations. So there are all Einstein manifolds. All of these guys are solutions of the Einstein equations, but they're rather special solutions. But there's much study by mathematicians, and there's a classification of them by volume growth. So if you like, an instanton, even though it's a four-dimensional thing, it can behave like a four-dimensional, like a three-dimensional, or like a two-dimensional thing. So this is a mathematical theorem that if you ask, given a solution of the self-duality equations, so an instanton, in four dimensions, there's a spectrum of volume growth. As you take the radial distance from a given point out and you integrate the volume, how does it grow? It could grow like you're in four dimensions, or it could grow like you're in three dimensions, or it could grow like you're in two dimensions or less. So then there's a kind of continuum below that. And the highest level is called ALE, asymptotically locally Euclidean. And the next level down is ALF, asymptotically locally flat. And ALF are the ones that essentially look like three-dimensional space asymptotically. And what does that mean? It means that the fourth dimension curls up into a fiber. So these ALF instantons all have the property that asymptotically they're fiber bundles of a circle of a finite size over a space, a three-dimensional and non-compact space. And they're the ones that we liked most. Okay, so they're the ones that have the best chance, we thought, of making contact with physics. And so these ALF instantons are the ones that I'll focus on. And how do we interpret them? There's this vibration, and we want, by circles, and we want to interpret the quantum numbers of particles in terms of topology. Well, there's the first topology right there. It's a fiber bundle asymptotically over the two-sphere at infinity that has a twist. That twist is what normally would be called magnetic, but we want to interpret that electric. So this is we dualize symmetries from the usual picture. So our model is, if you like, a dual Kaluza-Klein theory. So the circles are magnetic circles. So the picture should be magnetic circles over a three space. So that's, I think, what I just said. So that sums that up. And then so you can ask what solutions they are. And if you stick to self-duality, there's some famous geometries. There's the top-notch geometry. Actually, Euclidean Schwarzschild are smuggled in. That's not strictly a self-dual solution, a solution of the Einstein equation, but it's not self-dual. And then there's other solutions, like the Atiyah-Hitchin manifold. That's also self-dual. So these are all examples of these ALF solutions of the Einstein equations. And in this talk, one thing we also realized very quickly is that in all of these manifolds, as you know, four-dimensional manifolds classification is all in terms of if you assume simple connectedness, it's in terms of the middle cohomology. So just like Riemann surfaces are classified by the middle cohomology, that's also true in four dimensions, but it's more complicated. So you've got, it's not just a question of counting holes. You have the signature, the Euler characteristic, and you have the intersection form and whether it's even or odd. So those are properties of four manifolds, but they all have to do with the middle dimension. And so it's natural, and in fact, all of these guys have two forms which are dual to that cohomology, the middle dimensions, Maxwell fields. And these, so Euclidean Maxwell fields, and they are always there. They sort of come with the geometry. Since the geometry has a two-dimensional hole, there will be this this two form sitting on that. And those two forms, we also realized, are crucial in the story, so they'll be taken along. And so finally we said, well, if I, you know, so if I tell you I have a manifold which is fibered by circuits asymptotically, and I somehow argue that this is going to be a model for a particle, then I've given you an interpretation of the twist as electric charge of the particle, but all particles have spin. Where does that come from? But again, there's a natural spin space waiting for you to look at, which is the kernel of the Dirac operator. So the Dirac operator on four manifolds has an index which is studied, which depends on the geometry and on this twist, and which is the way in which we hope to make contact with conventional physics. So the zero modes of the Dirac operator are the things that give you linear spaces. This is a highly nonlinear theory, but the way we hope to make contact with usual quantum mechanics is through the Dirac operator and its kernel. That's where the spin space is going to sit.
You mean there's a U1 gauge field as well?
Yes, yes. So yes, I have to twist by this gauge field. So that's the kind of mathematical setting.
Are you putting spinners also?
Well, so I'm putting spinners on the four-dimensional space. But one thing that's not obvious is that they're going to be how they will transform under the. So if I now take this kernel, I have to break this kernel into presentations of the SU2, which covers the spatial rotation. So there's, you know, you have to sort of go from this four-dimensional pictures, which is fibered over three space, and then there's an SO3 acting in that three space, and you ask, how does that act on the spinners? Are there spinner half under that right. SO3 action? So that's one of the things that we want to answer.
You are introducing spinner fields on four dimensions.
Yes, correct. So that's the program that I have now outlined, and that's the program I want to sort of go through in the case of the Tarp-Knight manifold. A lot of that allows me to borrow results which go back to 70s and 80s, Hawking and collaborators.
According to the LHC, up to 14 TeV or 13 TeV in front two, there's no indication that the leptons are other than point particles.
I know, and that's a very good fit to what I'm going to say. So this is, in fact, it's a very good cue. Solitons are usually extended, which is what all of these guys are. The beauty of these four manifolds is that they have two kinds of solutions called nuts and bolts, but in Gibbons and Hawking formulation, which is where these, I told you there's this vibration asymptotically. That's not where the particles are. The particles are where the vibration fails. The vibration, the U1 fibers, collapse. That's where the particle is. And there's two things that can happen. Either they collapse on a two-sphere, that's called a bolt, or they collapse on a point, that's called a nut. And the Tarp-Knight manifold, I mean, that's a pun going on there, but that manifold is one where the U1 collapses exactly at one point. So it's a smooth geometry, which is somewhat point-like in three dimensions, but smooth in four dimensions. That's the trick. And where the particle is one point only, and yet it has a length scale, which is the length scale of this asymptotic fiber. But it's not the size of the particle. The size of the particle is zero.
So can we ever see the bolt?
Sorry?
Can we ever see the bolt?
Yes. Yeah, so the bolt is the in fact in Euclidean Schwarzschild it's the horizon. And except in the Euclidean version the whole kind of black hole inside is cut out. But it's a two sphere. So the bolt would be where we would expect to see baryons. So these are particles of finite size, and there's a finite region where this U1 fiber collapses. So protons, neutrons in this picture would be bolts, if you like, and nuts would be the leptons. So that's the model I want to look at, this Tarp-Knight model. And these are static, this is a static discussion. So these are four manifolds. I haven't anything about time evolution. But there is a interesting time evolution of Tarp-Knight, which we thought we had discovered, but it turns out to be rediscovered. I mean, I'd be curious to know how many of you know this time-evolving Tarp-Knight space. It's extremely simple, but I certainly hadn't come across it. It's kind of very hidden in the literature, but I'll come to that. So time evolution is another topic. So let me tell you the Tarp-Knight geometry, first of all. So Tarp-Knight, from my point of view, is a dual Kaluza-Klein picture of a magnetic monopole, because I'm going to dualize charges. So what's electric in the real world will be a twist here. Now, as you know, the Dirac monopole is a singular configuration. It's point-like, but with an infinite self-energy in a rather singular configuration at the origin. But we know how to smooth it out. One way is to introduce non-abelian gauge fields. That leads to the Atoff-Polyakov monopole. But the other one is the Kaluza-Klein monopole. So that's it's the idea there is that you take a geometry which where the fiber of the Dirac monopole is part of the geometry, but you just let the fiber go away at the point where the monopole is. So you get a smooth configuration in four dimensions, even though in three dimensions it looks like you have a singularity at that point. But the geometry is smooth. It's actually, in some sense, a much nicer way of smoothing out the monopole than the non-abelian story, which is more complicated. But so it's, from the four-dimensional point of view, incredibly simple. It's just R4. The top nut manifold is just R4. But what is R4? R4 is foliated by three spheres and a radius. So that's what I've written down here. And the three sphere is nothing but the total space of the Dirac monopole bundle. So that's the Hopf bundle over the two sphere, where the fibers are the magnetic circles in our picture now. But the base space is the two sphere. So this is just R plus, a radial coordinate times a two sphere foliating R3. And over it, you have a fiber. That sounds more complicated from the three-dimensional point of view than from the four, where you just have R4. That's it. So it's R4 is top nut as a manifold. So this metric, this Hopf-Dirac metric, I've just sort of written down this kind of standard formula, but the detail isn't really required. It's one of these Bianchi 9 metrics where you parameterize the three-sphere. You think of it as SU2, and you write down these what's called left invariant 1 forms, which really are body-fixed angular momenta. If you like, the three-sphere is, the, as you know, the configuration space of a rigid body, and the body-fixed angular momenta are these angular velocities, are these sigma 1, 2, 3. So they're kind of kinetic energies to do with the rotation. And these ABCs are the moments of inertia of that rotation. And then you have a radial coordinate and with which these moments of inertia change. And for that to be a four-dimensional self-dual metric, you have to satisfy these self-duality equations. Three of them, and their solution has been much studied. And the top nut solution is one where A is always equal to B. And when C vanishes, the third one, so when this fiber vanishes, then A and B also vanish. So there's a kind of one point where all the moments of inertia go away. That's when the three sphere shrunk to a point. And just to make it look a bit more familiar, I've written this, this SU2 matrix parameterized in terms of complex numbers, which will come back. So this is the only kind of technical slide that I need to sort of, take in, which is that I'm going to parameterize this angular dependence, this three sphere, in terms of two complex numbers that are constrained to satisfy the modulus as one. And if you're happier working with a kind of Euler angles, then you can switch to Euler angles by this formula here. And these Euler angles of the three sphere are well adapted to the fiber, which is psi, and the base, which is theta and phi in these pictures. And when you switch to these coordinates, the metric looks a bit more familiar, possibly, where you now have something that looks like a sort of Euclidean space, except you've got a squared and f squared there. And then you've got this fiber metric. Sigma 3 is, well, it's the fiber differential d psi, but it is coupled. That's the twist. I mean, this term tells you that this fiber bundle is twisted. It's not just a fiber d psi squared. It's twisted. In fact, if I took this away, this would be the general form of the Euclidean-Schwarzschild metric. I'll come to that. So Euclidean-Schwarzschild is not twisted, but top nut is twisted. And now let me try to tell you something new about top nut. It's the simplest solution of the self-duality equation, extremely well studied. There's the so-called Gibbons-Hawking form that I think many of you will recognize. But when you solve these equations, you always have to pick coordinates. You have to say, OK, what's my radial coordinate? And that amounts to picking f. This function f here is really up to you. It's just a gauge choice, if you like. What's my radial coordinate? And what's interesting is to pick the size of the U1 fiber as your radial coordinate. It's slightly unorthodox, but it works just as well. So rather than labeling the orbits of labeling these three spheres by the distance from the origin in our three, I can just label them by the size of the U1 fiber. Okay? This U1 fiber is the thing that goes to a finite size. So this way I get a compact range. And that turns out to be interesting. Yes?
Basic Lorentzian, can I think of psi?
That's time. Yes, that's the time which is weak rotated and becomes compact. That's right. So this is kind of the time, the RT plane, yes, that I'm looking at. Except I've chosen not to talk about R, but rather than I'm using this, well, what's, so C is the length of this U1 orbit, the size of this fiber. So if it doesn't really have a Lorentzian analog, because that would be infinite. You know, as you go out on the Lorentzian space, on the time orbits in the Lorentzian case are infinite, but in the Euclidean case they are finite and they have a radius, and that's what I'm calling C.
So you would just have a timeline telling back here, and it's normal.
Yes. 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 Yeah, yes. That may work.
In the Lorentzian case, this can disappear.
Yes, but there's no kind of, you know, that's called a norm of the metric, but there's no geometric orbit length. Yes. But how do you, that's not canonically, when you, there's no kind of, and here there's a U1 group that acts, which has a, and I can ask, it has a finite length orbit, and I can compute the length of that orbit. If you take me, if you give me a Killing vector, it has an arbitrary, there's no normalization, I think, that would.
There might be an overall, just an overall arbitrary normalization. Yeah, you might normalize it at infinity to be.
There's a general philosophy. If you've got, you know, compact groups acting, you can look at the size, you know, you can use their orbits as parameter, the orbit parameters, like the size of the two sphere, and here's the size of a circle. And that's what I'm using. I don't think it has a Lorentzian analog, but.
The Gibbon talking paper, the old one, they do talk about the nuts and bolts
yes.
in terms of the
fixed point sets
of the
correct
vectors. So
correct. Yes.
I'm just trying to understand here, what's the analog of like the time-like Killing vector stationarity, or when in these coordinates, or is it not obvious?
Well, so C equal to zero is a nut. So C is the length of the U1 orbits. When it vanishes, the Killing vector has a fixed point.
I see. So the orbit really is the fiber? Or the
correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's exactly right. So the orbit is the fiber.
Thank you.
So this is a picture of Tapnut that maybe you have seen. But so if you write down the metric in terms of this coordinate, you get this metric on the fiber. So this is this is now the fiber viewed of as a, you know, it's as a disk. And, you know, it's the U1 coordinate round the fiber, and then I vary the size of this fiber. So I'm, rather than thinking of it as a circle bundle over R3, I'm thinking of it as a disk bundle over the two sphere. So I've shifted my interpretation of the radial coordinate from the base to the fiber. And this disk bundle of the two sphere has fibers that have this geometry. So they have these cigar shaped geometries. That's just a two-dimensional surface. I can ask, is it embeddable, and what does it look like? Well, it looks like this. So so from this point of view, the Tapnut manifold is like a kind of Medusa picture. You know, you've got a head, and then you've got these cigars going out, and, you know, snakes going out in all directions. Okay. And it's twisted. So it's a messy Medusa picture. And with these cigar-shaped U1 submanifolds. Okay, John is.
So you're using a Hopf vibration?
Yeah, yes. But yes, it is the Hopf bundle. But I've now, rather than, you know, this radial coordinate, I can associate this radial coordinate, as one normally does, with the base, with the two sphere. Or I can think of it as part of the circle, and then it gives me a kind of a plane, but actually the plane is only a disk. It only goes to a finite range. So, and that disk has a geometry, which I've written down here. And it's the geometry that comes from embedding a cigar in Euclidean 3 space. So this is a picture that's only there to give you a visualization. It's not, you know, it's not embedded in the 4 manifold or anything like that. And yes, and it's only had one length scale in it, which is both the Gauss curvature at the tip and the size of the asymptotic fiber. So that's.
I mean,
yes.
It's not strictly speaking a vibration. I mean,
it because collapses at the origin.
Yes. That one point is. I think,
yeah, correct. So it's that's the typical picture that we want. Actually, you have a vibration away from the particles, but it collapses, and the geometry is smooth.
No, I meant your neither one is, but I mean, yeah. Even your second one.
Correct.
It's a vibration over
correct.
The tooth sphere. It's not really.
Correct. It collapses. At, you know, there's still, at this point, is the fiber is gone at the tip of the cigar.
No, but that's in the fiber now.
Yeah, but the fiber collapses.
And it's perfectly good over the tooth sphere.
I mean, the fibers are all identified somehow at that point. You see what I mean? It's not a product of an S2 cross. This fiber.
No, it's away from the origin. It's a disc bundle over the tooth sphere. And at the origin, the tooth sphere has zero size and the disc has zero size. It collapses. Okay, so both go away. But that's why it's smooth.
I know. I'm very familiar with this.
Yes, I know. I know you are. In fact, you discovered it.
But I'm just not understanding. Maybe it's a small technical point.
Right.
I'm not understanding much. You said it can be regarded as a fiber over the disc bundle over the tooth sphere.
Yes.
But
that's good.
But not quite, isn't that? That's not quite true. That's all.
It's collapsed, except at one point.
Except at one.
The origin
one of each fiber.
No, but that. Both the fiber and the tooth sphere. So both the fiber and the tooth sphere collapse.
Technical discussion
at one point.
Yeah, maybe.
Then can we move
yeah.
on to?
Okay. These coordinates make this top nut space look like a ball. Okay, so it's a three sphere times a radial coordinate has a finite range, and that's going to be a very important set of coordinates for what I want to talk about. So the metric near the nut is flat, and this is another thing. When you write down the top nut geometry in standard coordinates, it looks like there's a singularity of the origin, and these are the coordinates that are used to show that there isn't one. It's the same coordinates, and near the nut, it's just a flat geometry. Let me tell you how you get the standard coordinates that some of you may be familiar with. There you write down the Hopf image from S3 down to the tooth sphere, and you introduce a radial coordinate to combine that unit vector and the radial coordinate into a vector in R3, and the metric becomes isotropic. So this is the standard top-nut geometry. So there's a multiple of the flat geometry in R3 and Euclidean 3 space, and then a fiber coordinate. When you solve the self-duality equations, you get something which depends on two parameters. And this is something that is going to be crucial in this story. It depends on a length scale and also on an arbitrary parameter epsilon that appears here. So this is the form of that's usually set to 1, but it's quite important for us not to do that here. You can by rescaling metrics, but that's an important aspect that will come back. That's the metric, the top nut metric in the Gibbons-Hawking form, the more standard form where you have a metric on the base and a metric on the fiber. And this is finite, this is the circle, and this is the default metric on R3. So this is a sort of more standard picture. But I've given you another picture for a good reason. So these microscopic coordinates, that's what I want to call these guys, microscopic or spin, are different from these position coordinates. Okay, so this is the kind of position point of view. And in fact, it's, you know, so one, if I take the point of view that four manifolds describe particles where the fiber collapses, I somehow have to say how they project down to space. And you might think, well, you just pick these coordinates. You know, you just pick coordinates on this top nut space, which look like you put a vector on top of them to make them look like something in R3, but that's totally ad hoc. But actually, it's not. It's totally comes with the geometry, and that's an important point. The top nut manifold has a property called hypercalarity, and that means there's three moment maps, which are maps that that associate real numbers to any point on the manifold, and which are acted on by SO3. So this is part of the kind of top nut fact of being an instanton comes with this hyperkalar map, and that's exactly what these X's are. So these coordinates x1, x2, x3, which are, you know, familiar, but if you want to get them invariantly, they're just the moment maps of the hyperkalar structure. So they come with the geometry. That's a sort of point I want to stress. Okay, why did I include this epsilon parameter? Epsilon is a parameter which, when you take epsilon to 0, the metric really does become flat. That's not obvious, but when you set epsilon to 0 here, you have to change coordinates. And then the metric is just R4, flat R4. So this epsilon parameter is one that sort of takes you, as you switch it on, away from flat space to this top nut space. And it's kind of a compactification. Or if you like, if you go backwards, as epsilon goes to 0, it decompactifies. These are these circles which shrink at the origin, and as you go epsilon to zero, bang, they all become lines, and it's just R4. Okay, so that parameter would play an important role. Okay, I've almost set the scene for the, once the scene is set, the answer comes very quickly. So not to worry. I told you that these spaces have gauge fields, abelian gauge fields, or two forms, which are there because of the middle cohomology. Well, Tabnard is R4, so there's no middle cohomology. But nonetheless, it famously has an abelian instanton. This, I say famously because it played a big role in self-duality conjectures, where the Tabnard manifold arises as a moduli space, and quantization of moduli spaces required the cohomology of the middle dimension. And this form was kind of, it's been known for a long time. Noguchi and Hansen, I think, discovered it first. But so this is a self-dual two form, which is square integrable. And it's the D, it's an exact form, it's the D of a one form, which is not square integrable. So it does actually have a topology, but it's an L2 cohomology. So this form is exact, but not L2 exact. And Tabnard has non-trivial L2 cohomology. That's why this form is there. Okay? But it does come from the topologies. It's there from the L2 topology, if you like.
When you say it's not L2 exact, you mean there's something, a potential for it, but that potential is not L2,
exactly.
Not square integrable.
Exactly. And that's what this is. But so this guy is the two form that I mentioned. And now I'm going to twist the Dirac operator by it. And again, this goes back to something that was done by Pope. He studied the index of this operator. So this is the Dirac operator on Tabnard, twisted by this bundle. And he showed that this rather intriguing formula holds. So if you this coefficient p here doesn't have to be integer, because there's nothing to quantize it. It's just an arbitrary scale. You know, if there was a hole in the manifold, then integrating over it would force the coefficient to be integer. But there's nothing to do that here. So it's an arbitrary real number. And so you have to take these integer parts, slightly non-conventional integer, strictly less. But you get this formula, which clearly is reminiscent of summing integers up to a value of p. And Pope didn't really comment on that. He just kind of computed this index. And so with my student, we sort of wanted to understand this a bit better. And we wrote down we solved this again in these complex coordinates. And so here's a formula. And the formula is fairly complicated. But the important point is that what you see here is the polynomials in the complex coordinates are irreducible representations of SU2. Remember, these guys were just the complex coordinates on SU2, and polynomials in them carry the irreducible representations, with the coefficient j being half integer being the spin of that representation. So this is quite a nice way of writing down SU2 representations in terms of homogeneous polynomials in complex coordinates z1 and z2. So this would be something which has, it's a 2j plus one dimensional space. And look, the exponential here has exactly got the dimension minus the charge of the gauge field appearing in here. So this will decay only if 2j plus one is less than p, which is why you get this tower of SU2 representations up to p. And that's the kernel. It's the sum of all representations of dimension p up, well, dimension n up to p. Okay? So this is quite nice. So this gives a kind of interpretation of this kernel formula. And the other thing that's interesting is how it depends on this coordinate C, which is, remember, that was the size of this U1 orbit. Because if I now look at the case where P is 2 and J is a half, I get a doublet, spin a half state. And that spin a half state is actually pretty much, so I've written down W is C times Z. I'm not sure I wrote that down. But C is the fiber coordinate, and Z is my complex coordinate on this manifold. So this, remember, I said Tabnard is a ball where radial coordinate is C and the complex coordinates on the three spheres are Z1, Z2. Then the spin a half state is just a linear coordinate on that space. That's what this is saying. So it's saying the spin a half state, just take Tabnard as a ball, that is spin space. Okay, that space that you're looking at is actually the space of zero modes of the Dirac operator. So the manifold sort of gives you its own zero modes for free. And that's something we rather liked. So rather than saying, so in some sense at that point we say, let's go backwards and say that Tabnard space itself is spin space. It's acted on by SU2 in these microscopic coordinates. And you have a doublet of spin states right there. And the Dirac operator reproduces that. So the zeromost of the Dirac operator is of spin a half. It's exactly this complex coordinate on the ball. And in fact, the dependence on the z is exactly like in the skirmions, those who know that story. So the skirmion spin states have the same form. But here, these are the coordinates on the top nut space. Okay? So the spin a half state in this theory is the top nut, is a linear function on the top nut space itself, but written in the right coordinates. So I think that's rather, so we rather like that. And so that means that in some sense, top nut space is its own spin space, just linear functions on it. Are the spin a half states. I keep going on about this limit, epsilon goes to zero, and I think it adds a nice intuition. So if I've lost some of you, this is the time to tune back in. The limit epsilon goes to zero, everything becomes flat. The manifold becomes flat. This magnetic field becomes this constant magnetic field in terms of suitable coordinates on the plane. And the spinner states take this form. But those of you who did any sort of solid state physics will recognize those. These are just the Landau ground states. So in it sort of gives a nice intuition for what's going on here. But you have in the limit of epsilon goes to zero, you have just R4 with a constant magnetic field for the two planes that make up R4. You think of R4 as R2 times R2. In both components, you have a magnetic field. Constant, and that has Landau levels. And the Landau levels have exactly this holomorphic form. And that's the limit of these zeromost of the Dirac operator. So these guys in that limit become these Landau states in the plane. So this is a kind of, and of course, Landau is infinite degenerate, and it's lifted. As you go away from that limit, it becomes lifted into this spin representations of SU2. But that's a nice picture. And so this is really an aside. Once I saw this Landau level picture, I thought, I wonder if the top nut dynamics coupled to this magnetic field away from the epsilon zero limit is still solvable. I mean, again, some of you know this very well. The top nut geodesic motion is very interesting, and it's exactly soluble. It has a Runge-Lenz type conserved quantity, and you can solve it both classically and quantum mechanically. And in fact, if I ever teach quantum mechanics, the hydrogen atom again, I may use this. It's a much nicer setting. Everything is smooth, geometry. You can teach the whole kind of story of the hydrogen spectrum in a much cleaner setting. And so there's, but it's also known that without the magnetic field, it has no bound states. But if you couple the magnetic field in, it's beautiful. I mean, it remains solvable. It remains Runge-Lenz integrable. And I've sort of put this slogan here. It's a Landau problem in the fiber on this disk, coupled to a Coulomb problem in the base. And you can solve everything classically and quantum mechanically. It's rather pretty. But that's from this point of view, is a kind of aside. So I'll move on swiftly. There's a kind of picture that goes with that intuition. I told you that this is a fiber geometry of the top nut space. And those who study elementary geometry know that if you have a geodesic on such a space, it will ultimately always zoom out. Okay, so the Clairaut's theorem says that geodesics will wind round. They may move in initially, but they'll bounce back, and then they'll zoom off to infinity. All geodesics escape to infinity on such a surface. So that's why top nut, without magnetic field, doesn't have bound states. The magnetic field is a plug on this picture, and it keeps it gives you bound states, and that's why there's this nice spectrum. There's a negative mass top nut, which is actually also appears in the literature, where this cigar has become this funnel. And this funnel, infinity is here, has a singularity at some finite value of R. This one can capture GD6 on this side. So the ones winding around here, they will generally be captured on this side. And so that's why the negative mass top nut actually does support bound states. And it arises as an asymptotic limit of the Atiyah-Hitchin manifold. It does actually play a role, and we'll come back to it in a second. Right, that was spin. Now let me include time. So this is where there's a nice, well, to us, surprise. So this, I show this the way that we derived it, and then the disappointing realization it wasn't new, which is just to say, can we make a time-dependent solution by allowing some of these parameters in top nut to vary with time? And it doesn't work with L, but if you put epsilon as a function of t, and you work out the Ricci scalar in five dimensions, it's just a second derivative of epsilon. So it's Ricci flat, provided epsilon varies linearly with time. So there's an exact solution of the five-dimensional Einstein equations, where this manifold is kind of changing scale. And then I thought the one person who must know if this has been found is Gary Gibbons. So I emailed Gary, and lo and behold, he had solved it. But only in 2005. So this solution of the top nut plus one extra time, so it's a non-trivial extension of the top nut with a time dependence, was only found in 2005 by a rather long and convoluted step of dualities and contractions and so forth. So it's buried away in this paper from 2005. But you know, you can just get it by sort of making a naive guess in this case as well. So the picture of this time evolution is epsilon equal to zero, remember, was just R4. So what this is as you go forward in time, R4, one of the dimensions collapses to a circle, and that circle shrinks as you go forward in time. If you go backwards in time, the circles expand, become R4, and if you go through the R4, you end up with negative top nut. So there's a time evolution that satisfies the Einstein equations. It's a kind of ekparotic universe picture. You know, you start with a finite universe, you go through one that's actually flat, and then you come out the other side with one that's unfortunately singular, but still it's a top nut geometry. So this is a solution of the 4 plus 1 dimensional. So this is now Lorentzian. So there's a Lorentzian solution. And what's, again, surprising, possibly, at least to us, was that if you now play the same game with the gauge field and the spinners, they all come along for a ride. So if you allow the parameters in the gauge field to vary with time, then the same thing happens. You get an exact solution provided the time evolution is linear. So this is a kind of exact adiabaticity. You know, normally when you have parameters in the solution, allowing them to vary linearly will not give you a solution, but here that's what happens. But I should say, it satisfies the Maxwell equation, but it's emphasized here, it doesn't satisfy Einstein-Maxwell. So there's a coupling back, which we've ignored in this. Okay? So if you were to write down the full coupled five-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell theory, it doesn't satisfy it. It's only the linearized equations that are satisfied. So the background satisfies a nonlinear equation, but then the gauge field, a linearized equation. And the same thing happens for the spinners. And this again, is really, I've never seen anything like it. In watch what happens here. You put this in, you allow the parameter in the spinner to vary with time. And this time, you get a solution if and only if this p is constant and quantized. You know, p before was not quantized. P was any real number. But now it has to be quantized at the dimension 2j plus 1, which is exactly what's needed to make this exponential go away. And so then you get these solutions of the Dirac equation in that background. But they're exact solutions. So that's what that means, is that the whole picture that I gave you at the beginning of there being this manifold which has spin a half being more or less its own coordinates survives this time evolution picture. So the spin a half and the Maxwell field sort of ride along smoothly and satisfy, well, they satisfy their equations, but the full equation of fully coupled Einstein, Maxwell, Dirac, that we do not have. Okay, I think there's time to point out this rather cute link. And so this is the bit I would normally skip, but at the PI I feel I can talk about Dirac large number hypothesis. I don't know who I don't know how well known this is, but in a nutshell, if I understand it correctly, the large number hypothesis says that if you see large numbers in the universe, relate them to the age of the universe in suitable atomic units. So Dirac thought this was the answer to, you know, explaining why there are these large numbers. The answer is it's been because they've been around for a long time. And this model is, you know, if you now take this as a model of the electron, then it now has a time evolution, and it's not always been a fiber bundle. At time equal to zero, it wasn't a fiber bundle, it was just R4. So if you like, that's the Big Bang, and this universe consisting of one electron only. And as time evolves, the circle shrinks. And so you can ask, well, how long will it have to evolve to reach today's size? Well, for that, you have to decide what is today's size of this circle. And so the only length scale I could think of associated to a classical electron is the classical electron radius. okay, which is roughly this, it's roughly a Fermi. So you could, it's the size of a proton, which is actually a bit bizarre. But anyway, the classical electron radius is the length scale that we give to the fiber in this picture. And so if you take this solution where epsilon is t, so it just scales in time, and you ask, so you can see that the circle for large r, the size of the circle is L over root t. And the scale on the base is root t. Okay? So the scales on the base and on the fiber scale in opposite directions. And so if I identify the size of the scale on the fiber with L over root t, that's what the model predicts, and I identify the length scale with the cosmological scale, then the ratio of them is exactly the time of the universe, so the which is, in this model, 10 to the 41. So the point is that the ratio of the cosmological to the electronic scale in this model goes with time. So that's exactly Dirac-ian thinking, that the scale of atomic to cosmological is essentially determined by the age of the universe in atomic units. That's what this model does. So it scales the sizes oppositely. So this really, it's a Dirac monopole geometrized with a Dirac equation on it, and then it gives you the Dirac large number hypothesis. I mean, I think it's a rather cute observation. I don't know exactly what to do with that. Just because I finished this paper yesterday on the Schwarzschild, I wanted to tell you one thing about Schwarzschild, which I didn't know, and I'm curious whether anyone else knew this, which is when you write down the Schwarzschild space in the same fiber coordinate way that I've insisted of doing here. So rather than the Schwarzschild space is a trivial fiber bundle over R3 with the ball removed, the bolt removed. And again, the fiber collapses on the bolt. That's one of, it's the Gibbons Hawking classification. But I can again, instead of the usual radial coordinate that we all know and love, I can use the fiber size as a radial coordinate. So the U1 orbits. I can do the same game in Schwarzschild. And if I do that, I get a metric on this fiber, which is again a disk. And it's the same metric as for Tarbnat. So this is not something I'd known before. So there's no reason why they're both solutions of the Einstein equations, but the base and the overall geometry is very different. But the same sort of cigar-shaped thing arises in Euclidean Einstein, Euclidean Schwarzschild space, and also the Dirac operator. So you can do exactly the same things. So there's a Dirac operator, and there's a Abelian instanton. You can couple, and this time you get SE2 representations occurring with a multiplicity of their own dimension. So if you've got a p-dimensional representation, it occurs p times. But the same kind of story goes through. So you again get these spin states on Euclidean Schwarzschild in this case. But I'm pretty sure in this case there's no simple time evolution, at least not of the simple sort that we gave for Tarbnat. But apart from that, it's very, very analogous. Oh, yes, and then so there's some numbers. This is not experimental data, unfortunately. But the numbers have to do with looking at the spectrum of the Laplace operator, where because of this bizarre overlap with Tarbnat, and the fact that you can solve Tarbnat exactly. Again, I was curious if you solve the Euclidean Schwarzschild eigenvalue problem coupled to this magnetic field, if you can solve that numerically, and you can compute the eigenvalues, which are computed here. Okay, sorry, here. That's the eigenvalues computed numerically for this Euclidean Schwarzschild space. And this is the approximation from the Tarbnat picture. I mean, I told you that can be computed exactly. So I have a formula which I can just put my numbers in. And initially, they're not a mile off even at the beginning, but they get extremely close. And this is 0.01 of a percent difference for these eigenvalues. So the spectral properties of gauged Schwarzschild and gauged Tarbnat are remarkably similar, more or less because this fiber geometry is so similar. OK, I'll stop more or less by summarizing what I said. So the Tarbnat was our kind of simplest model to explore of this idea that particles are described by four manifolds which have a U1 vibration asymptotically but fail to be fibers exactly where the particle is. And so that's the one where we looked at the question, how does spin arise and how does time come in? And we found, I think, in both cases, very interesting solutions. We found an interesting exact time solution, and we found these spinner half states, which are the manifold itself. So that was really the kind of surprise. There's various neat links to this large number hypothesis, so the numbers have been letters have been switched around here. And the thing that we're looking at now, which is the obvious thing to sort of, you know, there isn't, you know, you might well ask, well, can you predict anything from this model? Is there any number? But you know, so far we only get spin a half and charge. You know, that we have a point-like particle with spin a half and charge one. So that you know, and that's the level of experimental fit. But anything more than that would require interactions. And luckily, there is a scenario, namely the multi-top nut space. So that, in our picture, would be the theater for exploring multi-electron interaction and spin states of multi-electron systems. And everything I've said carries through in principle. So there's, again, this U1 bundle is now more complicated. The Dirac operator is harder to solve. But in principle, a lot is known about this system, and that would be the arena for exploring what this model says when electrons interact. But with that, I'll leave it. So thank you for listening.
Yes. The spatial radius of the electron is about 10 to the minus 57 centimeters. Mm-hmm. The proton is about 10 to the minus 51 centimeters. Mm-hmm. Compare this to the Planck length, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the geometry of these objects, it's beyond.
Yes, but very, I agree. But this is not gravity. We have not used, I mean, even though these solutions are all known to all of us from gravity, we're not using Einstein's Newton's constant at all in this picture. So that's very important. And you know, this is meant to be a geometrical approach to unifying the other forces. I haven't talked about gravity. So we pick our length scales to match the particles. I'm not trying to describe the neutron as a black hole. That's not the idea. So it's we use these Euclidean versions. That's also important. So it's a different, you know, the fact that we end up with Euclidean versions of Lorentzian spacetimes, which are so well known, is actually a confusion rather than an intention.
So what do you use instead of G?
In our model, that's the free parameter. So we fix that to be the size of the proton in this case. So for the I haven't said what the Schwarzschild would be, but it would be a neutral particle because there's no twist. So maybe it's a neutron. Then the parameter L should be chosen to be the size of the neutron. That's the free parameter in our model. So the only length scale would be adjusted to that. Now I did say, so this is I did say that the Dirac operator has a degeneracy. So when you have, if you want spin a half in this model, you have to have a doublet of spin a half states. Well, if you like nuclear physics, that's not so bad. I mean, then this would suggest this is the proton and neutron. So I mean, this is actually very Sturm-like, that you get a kind of degeneracy of two spin half states. And that's what happens here. But I don't know. I mean, that's a speculation. But certainly, if you fit this to the neutron, you would say the size L is the size of the neutron. And that's it.
Is one of those states electrically neutral and one?
No, and that's the thing. Well, and there would be charge with respect to this U1, and one is neutral and the other one is charged. That's correct. But we want to think of that U1 as a dual. So there's a bit of a, we can't have our cake and eat it, I feel. That's why, otherwise I would be shouting triumph.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Can you go back to this large number hypothesis? I didn't quite understand. What is setting the cosmological length scale, and what is setting the...
Right. So L times root T is the coefficient of the metric dx squared, where x is a dimensionless free vector on our base. So we interpret that L times root T as the cosmological scale. And the coefficient in front of the fiber is L divided by root T.
Okay. So the fiber is getting smaller.
Exactly. And the base is relative to that
the
is expanding.
In some sense is expanding.
Correct.
I see.
Yes.
It's sort of the amount of expansion since the beginning. I mean,
yes, that's
from
right.
When a flat space
Correct.
Expands, you can't say how much.
Right, exactly. That's, yes, I agree.
It's like the scale fact, the topological scale.
So this solution, this time-dependent solution of top-knot is one of rescaling the top-knot metric as you go through time. So it's a time-dependent scaling of the solution as you evolve in time. But it's as a time-dependent solution, it's not trivial. At each point, I mean, if you just, well, you know what I mean.
So if this fiber direction were the electromagnetic, mm-hmm. either electric or magnetic, then it seems to me that you'd have a problem because the fine structure constant would be changing quite a lot during this kind of evolution. I'm not sure in the end in your interpretation if it is still the electromagnetic U1 or magnetic U1. But
it's a length scale. We identified it with the classical electron mass. So it's E squared divided by M, and that would be changing in this model. But you're right, the fine structure constant would be changing.
So are there about...
Sorry?
They're pretty, I don't know how stringent, but people obviously have looked at
yes.
set fairly strong grounds. Do you know whether or not?
No, this is part of the talk that I skipped, you know. But yes, I could check whether.
10 to the minus 5 to a register of 5.
10 to the minus 5, relative.
Up to a register of countenance.
After redshift?
Up to a redshift of 5.
Right, okay.
I guess you're saying after z equals 5.
Okay.
It was no more than 10 to the minus 5 different from what it is now. Is that the same?
So that's
a factor of. Redshift of 5 is roughly a factor of 6 in radius. So the question is would it not? One would worry that the fine structure constant would have changed.
Too much.
A lot more.
Yes.
Oh, you had a square root of, I'm not sure if
yes, had a square root stem, I'll have to ask relative to what?
But the square root was also in the other.
Yes, the relative change is 1 over t.
Sounds like, well, okay.
Yes, so are there other interesting manifolds that I'd like this?
Yes, I mean, so there's two that come to mind. One is the RT Hitchin, the other one is the top dot. So they're the obvious ones to look at. So they're both examples of having a bolt and then having a twist. So they combine what I've Euclidean Schwarzschild has a bolt but no twist, top nut is a twist but a nut and no bolt, and top bolt, as the name suggests, is a twist but it ends on a bolt, and it's not self-dual. RT Hitchin is self-dual. And actually, it doesn't strictly have a bolt because the U1 group isn't actually defined. It's only defined asymptotically. So it's a different thing. The U1 is defined asymptotically, and then it, in the core of the manifold, it's kind of gone. It doesn't make sense to say it has a fixed point. So RT Hitchin is not strictly a bolt in the Gibbons-Hawken terminology, but it for practical purposes, feels that way because you have a finite core region where the U1 is gone. And yeah, so they would both be the next ones to look at.
We can thank Bert today.
Thank you.